Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. Today I'm going to start with a quote. I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use natural resources of our land. But I do not recognize the right to waste them or to rob, by wasteful use, the generations that come after us. I ask nothing of a nation except that it has so behaves as each farmer here behaves with reference to their own children. That farmer is a poor creature, skins the land, and leaves it worthless for his children. The farmer is a good farmer who, having enabled the land to support himself and to provide for education for his children, leave it to them a little better than he found it himself. I believe the same thing of a nation. And that's Theodore Roosevelt actually providing a briefing in the New Nationalism speech in 1910. For someone that's been going at this for over a decade myself and committing to fixing many of the same issues that Teddy Roosevelt spoke about 110 years ago, previous work, I had an opportunity to be involved in using some of these creative approaches and looking at it slightly differently of how we can use financial modeling, how we can use more of a holistic perspective in trying to finally address some of these conversation points that Roosevelt spoke of over a century ago. So my previous career, I was involved in a private equity fund, and we had quite a bit of interest in looking at remediation of some of the poor practices we were using in producing food. And we were doing that through investing in soil health and in overall systems thinking. So we spent years doing due diligence and defining a financial model that would work effectively. It gave me an opportunity, actually, to meet many of the folks that we've had on Sourcing Matters in our discussions. In fact, I'd say a cornerstone for Sourcing Matters and what we're doing with this is showcasing those who are crafting solutions of change and not just lamenting about all the problems or the exposés of all the issues that are taking place. So the real people that are drafting solutions for change moving forward. The EAF Agrarian Fund was spooled up as a tool to get more money into proper land and resource management. Effectively, the concept was a brainchild of my co-founder, Jack Clark, who was an investment banker for 50 years and had experience in private equity and capital markets. He had worked in timber and TIMOs, an alternative energy, actually built the largest anaerobic digestion facility in the entire United States. He worked in production agriculture and food system refinancing. And all of that experience gave us pretty unique knowledge to craft something new, something innovative, a new model for financing domestic sustainable agriculture here in the States. We were acquiring stressed and distressed farms and converting them into pastoral livestock operations, which were committed to regenerative best practice to improve the land and increase soil health and fertility. Our approach was used for elevating production standards and to sell differentiated meat into diverse market scales. We were trying to use as a mechanism the financial models to open people's awareness to the values of investing in better land management. And unlike most agricultural vehicles, we did not rely on tenants or lease relationships. We really needed the farmers to be part of the ownership structure and operations. And we used to say that if you own a house, you paint the walls, you take care of that asset. And so we would seek and try to basically not maximize immediate profit, but to invest in long horizon values. We needed folks who recognized the value of investing in soil and clean water and healthy ecosystem, and who also would benefit from those actions. So there in the States, you know, we have an interesting approach here. We've obviously gone full tilt into conventional agriculture. We have developed a model that we've scaled globally, but we're realizing we have to claw some of this back. And what I found encouraging is the Agrarian Fund was not alone stateside. There's definitely been other models that have been for-profit entities that focus on ecological-focused land management. Programs like they're converting conventional croplands to organic And just to add some context to that, we have a deficit here stateside that we require another 4 million acres of production agriculture to even just meet the current demand for organic products. There are other financial vehicles that are looking at bridging the requirements for financial requirements for regional farms. We're looking at converting dairy farms, conventional dairy farms, to organic. And we also have ventures that are looking at technology that is enveloping the food system and production agriculture through food and ag tech. And there's even large LPs and GPs who are diversifying their risk portfolio through real asset investments in land or even food animals to meet the evolving needs and desires of modern consumers. So this is all pretty revolutionary. This has been an eye-opening experience, and a lot of that stemmed for me personally when I spent some time in Europe and I spent some time in the Netherlands. And while there, I was exposed to some very creative models and some new concepts that seem slightly different from the language we speak here stateside, but really with the same fundamental and functional requirements that we've just been speaking of. But with all that said, for the trillions we invest in tomorrow, whether that's on unicorn big swings or even a stable AAA rated federal or municipal bond, there isn't much going on in smart plan for something that many believe to be the biggest problem facing humanity over the next 100 years: how we're going to deal with our regenerative natural resources and how we're going to make this into a mainstay that everyone is interested and engaged in. So today we get to get a bit under the hood at this, and we welcome an expert in the space to share some thoughts and some insight with our listening audience. We look a little deeper into this international solutions and talk about some more of the appeal that they've brought to the market through a very creative mechanism. So today we have Willem Verwoerde from, he's the CEO of Common Land Group. Hey, Willem, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you for joining this podcast. I'm looking very much forward to tell you more about what I'm doing and where you are.
Yeah, thank you so much, and I appreciate it. I know you speak many languages, so I appreciate you working with me on speaking English here, and I do appreciate you coming on to share with our listening audience, which we do have international listeners, but mostly domestic in the U.S., about what you're up to at Common Land Group. So, well, let me do this. Let me make a quick reading of what I saw from your information, and then I'll jump in right there with the questions. So Common Land believes that landscape restoration offers tremendous untapped opportunities for sustainable economic development. To demonstrate the potential, we develop landscape restoration projects that are based on business cases. Multidisciplinary teams actively involve investors, companies, and entrepreneurs in long-term restoration partnership with farmers and land users. Long-term commitment is important as it takes approximately 20 years or one generation to restore a landscape. Our holistic restoration approach combines the connection of nature and economic landscape zones and delivers 4 returns. Our goal is to realize large-scale landscape restoration with local farmers, land users, and experts based on sustainable 4 returns business cases. And this is, again, your missions is to contribute to a large-scale landscape restoration industry aligned with international policies and guidelines. So, well, that's fantastic stuff. When I spent time in the Netherlands, I did have a chance to see one of your projects. But if you could you share with our audience a bit more about Common Land, how it came to be? And could you go deeper into what your 4 returns are and what are those returns and how do they materialize to drive change?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving the opportunity. Yeah, no, maybe just a brief explanation where I came from. I'm a tropical ecologist, and so I've been working for quite a while within the conservation world of IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, and especially in Latin America and India and other and African countries, and doing field projects on conservation worldwide and rainforest conservation and so on. And when I was working in the NGO community, I realized, you know, that most of those projects, first of all, they were, you know, funded by grants and donations, and often they were very isolated and short term, you know, four years max, maybe 5 years, and relatively small. We were talking about a few thousand hectares or more or less, but not really not really more. And if you consider the huge destruction of all these ecosystems, we all know that donations and grants are very important, but it's not the future. We just need to have a new kind of economic model. But when I was talking with business people and investors and farmers, as well as conservationists on all these topics, I realized that there was a huge problem. They just didn't talk a common, there was no common language, there was no common framework, there was no common model that they could use. Everyone was in their own silo. And so basically I left IUCN, I was director of IUCN Netherlands, and I left that organization in 2012 and decided to go for a sabbatical and try to find a solution for this language and monitoring model as well. Could there ever be something like a model or a framework that everybody could use and was willing to use so that they had a common language to solve these issues and help to bring investment money into this domain, to kickstart this restoration economy or ecosystem restoration industry, whatever you could call it. So I traveled, I interviewed a lot of farmers and I interviewed a lot of investors. So I went to like 14 countries in 2012-13. And also visited investors, mostly institutional investors, pension funds in London, Frankfurt, Amsterdam, and New York. And I asked them two questions, both the farmers, poor and rich farmers, as well as the investors. The first question was, what frustrates you most? And the second question was, what is your dream? And the farmers actually almost all, had a similar answer. Their biggest frustration was that they couldn't hand over their land in a better condition as they had received it, and their dream was to be better paid for the products of their land, but also for their role as stewards of that land, and that didn't exist. And interesting enough, it was the biggest frustration of most of the investors was that they couldn't find pipeline, real sustainable pipeline that was holistic, systemic, and had a long-term view on things, where ecology was the driver or a very important part of it. They really couldn't find good pipeline, and that's why they couldn't invest in what they called real sustainable projects, and thus they couldn't explain it to their kids when their kids were asking them about how dad was dealing with their future. So that was a personal frustration as well. So their dream was finding pipeline that was really regenerative or restorative instead of doing things less bad. So those two things actually came together, and I thought, when I went back to the field, I'm an ecologist, I'm a field guy. I went back to the field and I saw these nasty, degraded landscapes, in Africa, in the Mediterranean, but you can find them everywhere, as you know. And I realized that most of those landscapes were empty. People have left or were leaving, but there were also they lost in a way their own purpose. So when you spoke with farmers in degraded degraded areas, they and their kids left to the city, they were less proud. They lost their pride, and that brought me to the idea of basically that each landscape, each degraded landscape, has four losses. It's not only a loss of biodiversity and fertile soils or vegetation cover, let's say natural losses. It's also about a loss of economic activity and a loss of social community feeling, jobs. But maybe the most important thing that I found in those landscapes was that people lost their purpose, their sense of meaning. So when I looked into those four losses, and most of these four losses were caused by the current model of maximization of return on investment per hectare. If you every businessman, and I've been a businessman before in tourism before I started in the conservation world, and it was all about maximization of profits, maximization of your return on investment in a short term. But if you add those two words per hectare, you get degraded landscapes wherever you are. So how to turn that maximization return model into another returns model, and every farmer and every investor understands what a return is, I decided let's make a language model that you can monitor and evaluate and will also be accepted by experts. But I need to make it as simple as possible so that people can join around the table, different stakeholders, and start a landscape restoration partnership. So if a degraded landscape is caused by has resulted in four losses, then a restored landscape is about four returns. And that means that you need to start with bringing back return the inspiration at the community level. Then with that inspiration, will bring back hope, create and find ways to create jobs. So the social stuff, the social return comes back. But to do that well, you need to restore the biodiversity. That means you need to return the natural capital. You need to return the natural system into a system that brings back ecological functionality. And those three returns, let's say the inspiration return, the social return, and the natural capital return, will bring sustainable finance. And that can be anything. Sustainable agroforestry projects, restoration of soil, composting, all those things. That means all those technical things to really create, again, valuable, productive soils that produce all kind of food and fiber systems and so on at the landscape level. But if you have those four returns, it's not enough. We need to, and then my expertise as an ecologist came. Ecologists always think in zones, landscape zones. So what I did is I brought in this four returns model, the ecosystem approach of IUCN and the Convention on Biological Biodiversity. And an ecosystem approach is a holistic approach of identifying a certain scale, an ecosystem scale, and each ecosystem you could divide it in different zones. But if you really bring it back to, let's say, the key zones, you talk about a natural zone, a combined or let's say agroforestry or mixed zone where you have commercial as well as ecological functions in a kind of a balance, and an economic zone where you do the processing, where you have cities and where you have infrastructure. And if you look towards a landscape with three zones, or vision, then you can identify in which zone do I live, and do we do the right thing to restore that zone, or is it from an ecological and an economic perspective the best place to do this or to do that? So four returns, so three zones are delivering four returns, and then, another component was needed, and that was the time component, and that was, of course, also a language tool. I mean, here the time for investors, is always a difficult thing, because investors want short term, they want to have an exit strategy, they want to have a maximizing ROI, and they want to have less risks or no risk at all. But time and ecology is about long term. So I thought, let's just talk about one generation. Farmers will understand that. Some investors will understand that. And I took the number of 20 years. So three zones are delivering four turns within 20 years. Basically, that is the model.
I'll say, well, you make it sound very concise and straightforward. I can tell you've put a great deal of thought into this. And what I, being in the space and looking at how complex it is and how challenging it is within taking a broad system that you don't have control of each one of the parts and breaking it down to a narrative that people consume is supremely challenging. And I think you couldn't be more exact, whether it's internationally, whether it's in the EU, whether it's in the US, there is no common language. There is no common monitoring framework. There's nothing that are looking at returns besides just fiduciary returns and what that really has to represent, these multidimensional returns. And I think that's something that we have seen with groups like the UN's SDGs, which are maybe defining common descriptions or narratives of things, but not necessarily stitching them together in an overall plan for remediation and adding value back to it. So that's very exciting. And let me ask a question off with something you said. You picked 20 years, one generation. Is that a nimble number that will evolve over time as you get more of the test cases up and running? Or do you think it's a generation because ultimately it's individuals that are operating this overall four return, three step system? So a generation makes sense because of who is shepherding the program.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, what helps a lot, because, you know, this is the theory, you could say. So I published this and in a peer-reviewed report in 2015 with, you know, with nice logos of UN parties on it. But the 20 years is part of the transformation process. So the model in itself is transformation. For instance, if you start talking with a farmer and you ask, you know, how should this landscape look like? What is your dream? Normally farmers don't dream. It's very tough for a farmer to say, oh, my dream is this and this. No, they live from day to day. But if you say, listen, let's team up for the coming 20 years and longer to make this landscape a landscape where you can live in, where more people can come back in a way that is ecological and economical sustainable, you know, then he really starts listening, because no one is telling or asking him, shall we do something together for the coming 20 years? So the fact that you say that is already transformational. It changes his way of vision and being, and of course most of those farmers will will never believe that if you say that you actually are doing that. But basically, you know, at this moment, that's what we started to do since 2013. So we designed the model, and then we just wanted to do it to make sure it works. So we are now building track records, and of course within such a landscape model, you develop all kind of different business cases. And one business case could have could already have a kind of a financial return within 5 or 6 or 7 years if you talk about regenerative almonds or regenerative whatever beans or whatever, but others need much longer time frames. And I realized that, you know, if we again talk about a 1 or 5 years plan, it doesn't work, because for a system approach need much more time. But within that system approach, within that landscape, let's say 1 million hectare, we work in Spain. I just came back yesterday from Spain. We work on a 1 million hectares area. The almonds can produce regeneratively within 7 or 6 years, and the pistachios as well, and lavender, you know, within 4 or 3 years already. But the system as a whole, before it really works well, it takes much more time. And before you really build soil in a very poor Mediterranean system and are able to bring back water systems and so on, it takes much more time. So it's a first start, that framework. And it's an invitation to talk around the table with different stakeholders and create a shared vision.
Yeah, I think that's an essential part. As you're saying, defining a multi-stakeholder initiative, getting people to harmonize interests and to say, even if at that 20-year horizon, we're going to try to meet the same goals, that's a very It's a very positive step. And but I, you know, I'll revert back and say, well, you know, proof's in the pudding, right? So let's prove this. But what I've been reading about what you've done is you do have that proof. You just mentioned the million hectares, which is 2.3 million acres in Spain. But you also have projects in South Africa. You have one in Western Africa and obviously your home country of the Netherlands. Could you share?
Western Australia.
Oh, Western Australia, excuse me. Western Australia and South Africa, pardon me, or Southern Africa. Please, could you share with our audience a bit more on some of those projects and what you've learned in the 5-6 years of being immersed into this?
I've learned. That's very. I've learned how many hours do we have? No, I think. So when we started. I wanted to start, first of all, with a good team, a multidisciplinary team. So one of the first lessons was, where can I find someone who can fund our team for the coming years before we can make any money? It will take at least 6 or 7 years. So some angels, and we were able to find some angels to help us and work on this. That's the first thing. So yes, there are people around who are willing to philanthropists who really want to make this happen and see that they can play a role in making this change. I think another thing is that what we did is that we used another stakeholder management tool called the Theory U. It's a stakeholder management tool it's basically about co-creation, and it's developed by the Presencing Institute of MIT. That we use that Theory U, that U-curve model, in the different areas we work. So we really very carefully selected the areas where we are now working. We used issues like criteria like land tenure, like local leadership, like political the political systems, and of course the opportunities to restore these degraded ecosystems within 20 years with a lot of productivity. So we very carefully look to the ecology of the and productivity of the or potential productivity of those systems, and we ended up in dry subtropical areas like Western Australia, Southern Africa, and the Mediterranean, Spain, in those regions. It took us a year at least to identify those areas, and only in Spain, for instance, we visited 53 areas before we identified the place where we are working now. So so it's very important you carefully do the due diligence well. So prepare your stuff. When we went to those places, we used existing networks of farmers and conservation organizations and identified the different stakeholders, and all those stakeholders who were there welcomed our approach after a first session. So we did a first U-curve session, and that took us 3 days. We brought together like the 40 or 50 landscape leaders that could be mayors, that could be farmers and conservation people, but also people working in the water systems and so on. We brought them together around the table. We explained the model and asked them to dream. So that's what we did. We asked them to dream how those landscapes would look like if they could, with that common language tool, if they could identify how that landscape looked like within 20 or maybe 25 years. And with that methodology, we identified a kind of first draft plan for the coming 5 years. What do we need to do to make that dream come through? And all, they were dreaming almost all the same dreams. Yes, for instance, in Spain, yes, they wanted to have a regenerative agriculture forms. Yes, they wanted to bring back, to open up the schools again, bring back the kids and the younger generation, all kinds of rural jobs in the rural area, having the productivity within the area, the production and the processing within the area instead of outside, being organic, regenerative, all those things were there, and producing water, producing carbon, all these things were in their dreams. So we connected that and we brought those dreams to reality by working with them on the map. So we were sitting around the table on the map. So where are people? So and identifying different activities that were already going on, and connect, and meanwhile we were able to connect those activities to, let's say, the ecological functionality. So we brought together basically four things around the table. We mobilized them, and we still are mobilizing them using this stakeholder management tool. Second thing is we brought in international and national knowledge from universities and NGOs and so on. The third thing, we brought in a different way of looking towards business development. Instead of monocultures of almonds, for instance, although organic, we brought in agroforestry system thinking and how almonds could be the driver of change within a new kind of agroforestry with pistachios, with different species. That's in the case of Spain. In the case of South Africa, it was aromatic oils instead of overgrazing by goats. And we brought in a different way of looking towards financing a landscape instead of only financing one project or one company. And we could do that because we are still partly funded by philanthropists, because it takes some time to work towards the first business case. And basically there are two things you need in such a landscape. You need a social engine and you need a business engine. And the social engine is, let's say, an association of stakeholders, people who are living there and don't want to move, but really want to make the change and are from the region. And they, with our help, can create new business models that are regenerative instead of destructive. And then the investors can come in.
Yeah.
That takes normally, a few years.
You've defined these proof of concepts. I can see how you're formulating this and working on that social change. That makes a great deal of sense. And I would say even, if this is your first draft that you presented, these MSIs, these multi-stakeholder initiatives, were your first draft to engage in those communities, people that would reap the benefit the most from bringing back these thriving communities, good ecological and economic development. Really, the four returns, as you had mentioned, they reap much of that benefit, whether it's in Spain on these million hectares of almonds, or wherever in the world that needs this. That makes sense. But let's talk to the next step of saying. I read in one of your papers that healthy landscapes and water systems are the basis of our life, right? And I think many folks with resources look at those water systems and landscapes and food as a constant. It's a given, right? It's just going to show up. It's there. I don't have to think twice about it. It's not in their day-to-day, never even something they may think about in an annual basis. So how do we break from those constants? How do we get people aware of this? And to me, even on the financial side and the financier side, those things like soil health, water, carbon, where this fresh nutrients is coming from, many of those aren't even commodities. They're not even given any kind of a value in our economic system. So how do we change people's awareness on the social change, and then on the financier side, how do we get them to appreciate more of this importance that we can't have business as usual, and it's in their fiduciary responsibility and best interest to look at these four returns as a future vehicle for themselves and their organizations to put money into?
Yeah, no, that's of course a very tough one. So what we did, first of all, we are working on an ecosystem, a landscape basis. So we identify an area, and we prefer to work in large areas because ecology will work for you if you work in larger areas that are a kind of an ecological unity. So Spain is an altiplano. South Africa is a water catchment, basically the water catchment for Port Elizabeth. The wheat belt in Western Australia is one large plain, which has been completely deforested because the British wanted to have wheat instead of forest there. And in the Netherlands, we work with a degraded wetlands or peatland system, basically the whole area around Amsterdam. So it's 125,000 hectares. And all those systems have similar problems. They're overgrazed or over-degraded and so on. So let's say what is happening is that the crucial ecological functions are disappearing. And so what we do with our model, we can explain to investors, and we have different tools and drawings and so to help them to understand that it's all about risks. So if they want to invest, let's say, in the wheat belt in Australia, in, let's say, in cereals, it doesn't make sense to invest in cereals in the wheat belt if the forests are still disappearing, if the weather has become hotter, if the soil is washed away or you know, by wind erosion. Why should you invest in that? The risks are too high. So let's first talk about those risks. And you can talk about those risks if you think in those in natural zone management. So you need to restore, let's say, the natural system to produce sustainable regenerative wheat in the wheat belt of Australia, or to produce almonds, you know, rain-fed almonds in Spain. It doesn't make sense to invest in large almond companies or even lettuce companies or whatever kind of agriculture companies in those areas if the whole natural system is collapsing due to 500 years of clear-cutting, overgrazing, and so on. So we use the figures of the UN studies called TEEP. Maybe you've heard of it. It's the economics of ecosystem and biodiversity. These studies of TEEP, the economics of ecosystems and biodiversity, are very, very well done over the last 10 years. And I very much use those figures to show that if you lose, let's say, the ecosystem services, you will lose everything. Because those figures are telling us that, you know, maybe you know those figures, but you know, the value of an hectare of rainforest is much more than the value of an hectare of soy. And so on and so on and so on. But the value is a different thing, of course, for an investor than cash. And that's. But we explain to them that these values are values because we talk about risks. So we now can explain to investors that if they join us in this holistic landscape forest management system, we will work. We will do the stakeholder work pro bono, while at a certain moment, they can step in because we are managing the risks. And they understand that we are managing the risks. So at a certain moment, if we have developed one or two or three companies locally owned by farmers associations, we knock on their doors and say, okay, now it's ready. Now we need long-term investors. Another thing is, don't want to talk with a lot of investors because they're just in their mindset. They're business as usual, and we don't want to work with people with that mindset.
Yeah,
because it's, you know, we don't have too many resources to convert those people if they really want a short return and a double digits and so on.
Yeah, and as you said, there's only so many hours in the day, right? And there are enough people out there that do care about this that you can make a go at it and get people to be on the same team and looking towards the same objectives and goals.
Yeah.
And I'd mention, yeah, I couldn't agree more. Those quantifying externalities, things that we've taken, you know, basically into for granted, whether it's our food costs or just even any materialized goods, there are always externalities. And often because we've had an opportunity, I would say, to live within, you know, a life of equivalent of royalties in years past, where we would have whatever at our fingertips is needed. Well, we're now realizing that's not sustainable, so we have to start adding things to it that really get into a true cost accounting that look at the impact of these externalities, and let's let the consumers to be involved in that equation, that discussion. And that cues me up for my next question for you, Willem, if I could. We're obviously, when dealing with stakeholders that are directly involved, whether in those communities or on the farm or investors, you know, that multi-stakeholder initiative, MSI, makes complete sense. But let's take it a little more holistic, or maybe a little more ethereal here. We've seemed to lose as a collective, I'll step back and say, we've seen a certain level of citizens awakening to certain things, plastics in the oceans, emissions from cars, and it has generated quite a bit of interest. We need to define new change. We got to look at things differently. We have a finite resource. Planetary boundaries are part of our reality. So how do we deal with that? But we've seemed to lose the sight of the horizon. This is what supports our life and our succession, our lineage. In fact, we know more about celestial bodies and now Mars than we do know about the soil underfoot or the sea sustaining planetary stability. I read that you described this as, again, the most pressing issue facing humanity in recovering our relationship with nature and its ecosystems. So how do we do that? How do we get past the fact that most folks are more engaged with what Tom and Giselle are wearing at the Met Gala, or that Kim Kardashian's blowing up the internet next, or even that we have some great-hearted and valuable celebrities that are trying to do things that, but maybe misguided in their approach, but they have amplification. They're getting the masses to look at those things. How do we gain more tilth in this movement? How do we make it sexy and topical? And I don't know that, I'm not saying that you have all the answers or that this is this, but you've been immersed in this. You get it. You're a very deep thinking guy. I just love your opinion, your thoughts. What would you share with other people in the industry that you've seen as at least a positive note?
Yeah. Now, first of all, the positive note is, of course, that this is all possible. So I'm super optimistic about the time where I'm living in now, because 20 years ago it was just not possible. It was too early. But the crisis is going so far, the ecosystem crisis and fueled by climate change and so on, that it's just a no-brainer. We need to do this. It's just nothing else we can do. I think you really formulated it very well in your introduction. But to bring it to the general public, it's tough. What we see, we use images of the Lust Plateau restoration project. It's filmed by my colleague John D. Liu. Beautiful pictures where people really become very happy if they've seen barren hills changing into green valleys. Although the problem, what they forget, is that there's 20 or 25 years in between those two images, mm-hmm. and it's hard work. But the true cost discussion, I think you have had meetings with Volker Engelsman, a friend of mine, mm-hmm. on this topic. This is the real essence. People don't pay for restoration. They pay for degradation in all those products. And how to make this sexy, I think... At this moment, for us, we are almost getting there that we can communicate what we are doing. So far, we didn't communicate where we're doing, because I first wanted to know whether this theory was working. We gradually now see that it is working, and the first investors are coming on board. And just to explain how we try to communicate this, I give you an example of what we did in Australia. And of course, Kim Kardashian was not involved in it yet, but just to give an example. So in Australia, we started with a different concept. We didn't start with first setting up a farmers association or a social movement. Because in Australia, it's different than Europe or South Africa. So we started with business, and we started with a company. A company is called Wide Open Agriculture. So the name Ecosystem Restoration is not in that company. It's a farm. It's a company about farmland, about farmers, and it was set up by Australian our Australian partners who are from that Western Australian region, and they advised us, let's start with a company that gives hope to the people, but meanwhile also brings jobs back by producing something, in this case food, tomatoes and lettuce and so on, so vegetables. And those vegetables are holistic, restorative. And they started with shade houses, create shade houses to produce those vegetables for the Perth market. And of course, later they want to produce for the Chinese market as well, because Perth, the whole area, it's a huge area. But they sold the story of the Four Returns landscape restoration through that producing company. And at a certain moment, I think it was 2 years ago, those people, our colleagues said, let's start an IPO process and use the IPO process to reach out to farmers living in that area, because they understand what business is and they understand what an IPO process is. And build the holistic landscape restoration movement through an IPO process. And of course, we thought, wow, this is really tough. And first of all, you need to write down, you need to your prospectus, a stock exchange prospectus. It's all very much, it's 100% return on investments and bringing down risks. But the great thing is they were able to write a Four Returns story in their prospectus. Can you imagine a Four Returns holistic landscape restoration business model, in a commercial prospectus, and they used the words in such a way that they were able to raise $5 million Australian dollars to start a company, and it's now the first holistic listed landscape restoration company in the world. We just closed in beginning of July, and who are the investors? Most of the investors are farmers living in that area who understand that this is the only way forward. And of course, they couldn't put in a lot of money because they're farmers. They're not rich, not very wealthy. So we combined their, you know, those investors with some European, impact investors who are thinking long term, and those people who really wanted to have that change. But the fact that we did the holistic story, the communication of this holistic message through an IPO process, proved for me that it is able, you know, that this that time is ready for these innovative things to break through within a few years. So and I think that it's a first small example. I think that it's possible to communicate it in such a way. Of course, this case is not, you know, it's still not big. It's still a first step, but it shows that people are receptive to message. And what was the most important message? It was not money. It was hope.
Yeah.
It was hope. It really brings back hope and peace.
Yeah. And yeah, and just opportunity for all. It's I think that's a very positive example. And I look at those to say, boy, I hope we can take a page out of everyone's book that are dealing with this. I mean, Western Australia being a great example, because, you know, they're not living through climate change. They're living through climate adaptation. That has evolved. Things are different there, right? And we've seen this happen in other parts of the world, and many of the restoration projects you're working with in common land are directly there, where things from 40 years ago, the weather patterns have changed drastically and they're not coming back. So let's be pragmatic. Let's be approaching. I couldn't agree with you more. If we're the shepherds and we're the ones that have great capacity of reversing this, it is the opportunity where it's social change and hope that matters greatly there. So last fall, you had a royal address on sustainability, and you had mentioned this. As you said, ever since the publication of the 1972 report from the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth, we have known that our economies are built on quicksand and that they rely on the exploitation of nature and landscape. Countless publications have since confirmed this. What is new, however, is that the message has finally reached other industries and governments courtesy of climate change debate. So we're using, I think you're looking at more of that citizens awakening around climate change debate. But here's my question, and this kind of throws a new dog in this. Levels of corruption, right, or concern. So the U.S. has recently demonstrated that the commitment to COP21 Paris agreements were elective. And this is not a tough approach that we've taken, that these are not regulations or restrictions, but it was an elective opportunity. We've gotten through a tough and a political change of wind here in the U.S., and those commitments are not much more worth much more than just the discussions that were had at that point. So with that said, you know, I look at that as our current administration has given us an incredible opportunity for purge, to flush our biome, to get people that are really forward thinking and looking. So maybe in the long run, ripping the Band-Aid off will help us in greater fashion for the environment and for food systems. There's a positive take on it, right? But so my question for you is, aside from the proof of concept projects like Common Land and a few other progressive initiatives in private equity and capital markets that I had mentioned in the beginning, what else can be done here with this? And where's the greatest hope? Is it working in conjunction with governments, free market, NGOs, and working with educational resources? Is that your goal? Do you see that as a great potential for Common Land to be an aggregator of public-private entities?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah. No, actually, our goal is... Our final goal, you could say, is that we just want to have a new two things, I think. First of all, we want to make sure that investors see and understand that they invest in landscape as a whole, not in projects. So you can, for instance, in Spain, we understand that, you know, we foresee 50, maybe more businesses in that area, probably 100, who can all be regenerative. And so that then we are talking pipeline, right? But for governments, so far, and especially democratic governments, you know, you mentioned the U.S. I can mention lots of governments in Europe. They all have short-term visions, and this is not about short-term. This is about long-term, doing always the same thing. So it means that ecology, in fact, and the understanding of ecological systems are the new basis of our economic development. That to understand that well, you need to do it and test it. But basically, the whole understanding of how ecological processes work and how they interact with economics, you know, that has been proven many years, and we know how it works. So it's only leadership in governments and long-term leadership like you mentioned Theodore Roosevelt, they are able to change some indicators or criteria in the system to make sure that that the benefits of ecology are conserved, protected, and restored. And it could be a tax system. We have been talking about carbon tax or water tax or sugar tax or all kind of whatever things. But we need to work towards these systems to make sure that let's say we honor and we value the ecological the ecological production or the ecological resilience of our food, water, and security systems. This is so crucial, and this point of understanding is coming nearby. We are working in China. We see how China is dealing with these issues. They take this more and more very seriously. I think it's the only country where they have where they are now building on a policy where ecological restoration is one of the cornerstones of their economy. And it's for a good reason, because they have no other choice to do it. They don't have a lot of land. They have a lot of Chinese. But I think they will take that leadership seriously. And of course, they have one other thing. There's only one landowner in China. That makes stakeholder management pretty easy. And so that's
dance with who you brought, right? You got I got it. I think, you know, it's great that
my dream is,
yeah, please,
this returns three zones methodology becomes a policy.
Yeah,
and not for 20 years, but, you know, for 100 years or longer. Okay, maybe I'm a dreamer, but I think it's not a dream, but it's very realistic. Just to finalize one sentence, because I know we're running out of time, but
yeah.
A few years ago, company and corporate leader came to me and said, "Hey, listen, you're doing lovely things, but it is a bit idealistic, isn't it?" And I couldn't find a good answer to that. And now I have the answer. I just turned it around and said, "Hey, listen, I think I'm pretty realistic. I think you're just a dreamer and an idealist if you just keep on going business as usual." And the great thing is, immediately we have a good conversation.
Yeah, it's maybe less of a dream and more of a vision, and you're executing upon that vision. And I think your strategy and approach for weaving that into the fabric of where the current models are set up internationally is very creative, very innovative. And to that point, that the folks that are going to need it the most will be the ones that will move this along. The forced innovator idea of innovation economies. Boy, any of us that are lagging behind there, specifically, again, our state, the states, and what's happening stateside of being lethargic and letting other people's pass us by in innovation economies, well, that will be felt in due time here. So there's a economic approach and appeal to it as well. So, Willem, fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Where can our listeners learn more about Common Land? And I know John's been very active with some of those wonderfully produced and filmed videos and movies of what you've been active with. Where can folks find more information about this on the internet?
Yeah, most of it is on commonland.com. And increasingly, we have a Common Land YouTube site, but still not everything is on the web yet. More will be published later this year when we can more put our track record and our experiences on the web.
Hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I'll put a link in the write-up of this on the site so that whether it's in iTunes or on the website, people can have access to that. So I'll close by saying that, you know, for any of us, anyone in this discussion, we all have a horse in this race. We are all stakeholders here. And to Willem's point, you know, we all have to explain this to our kids. The question becomes, what did you do when you knew? I love that quote. I think that's a great line that people look at, that that's going to be something that our kids or grandkids have every right to ask us. When we did know what the actual cause was, what we knew when it was our actions, our practices, well, what did we do to solve that problem? What I think Willem has done very well with the Common Land and with these other examples we had mentioned is it's not just looking at only as a philanthropic approach or that we must have or pointing fingers, but they are getting, they're rolling up their sleeves, getting their hands dirty and making this an approach that will be an economic driver, a new cost basis for a future economic model around the world. So, Willem, I thank you again for taking the time to share these thoughts, and I look forward to speaking with you soon.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me there, and hope you have a good day.
You too. And thank I'll you. Say until next time, thanks much.
Until next time. Bye-bye.